Hello and welcome to the My OT Journey podcast. Your host for the show today will be myself, Alex Connolly, a second-year graduate student with VCU's OTD program in Richmond, Virginia.
And myself, David Laguvi, a second-year CODA student at HCC Coleman College for Health Science in Houston, Texas.
We have the pleasure of interviewing Diane Simons, who is a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University and a staunch advocate for the field of occupational therapy. Diane Simons is also currently serving as assistant chair for the Department of Occupational Therapy at VCU, a fellow with the American Occupational Therapy Association, and helps to spearhead the collaboration between ART for the Journey and a local senior-assisted living residency in the Richmond area to implement the Opening Minds Through ART program. Diane received a Bachelor's of Arts in ART from Virginia Tech, Go Hokies, a Master's in OT from Virginia Commonwealth University, Go Rams, and a Doctorate in Education from the University of Virginia. And I guess for solidarity's sake, I'll say Go Wahoos. She has also been involved with numerous academic publications and grants and has been serving as a representative from Virginia to the American Occupational Therapy Association Representative Assembly since 2011. She has also been serving as the Virginia Occupational Therapy Association consultant to the board since 2013 and sat on the board of the Virginia Occupational Therapy Association from 2011 to 2013. All right, so hello, Diane. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Hope you both are too.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I'll go ahead and get started. I know from being a student in your class how involved you've been from within the field of occupational therapy, and I've witnessed your passion for the field. So I was wondering, can you explain what drew you to OT?
Wow. It was actually meeting an OT in Florida who originally drew me to the field. She was working with adolescents with psychosocial issues, and she used a lot of art activities with them. And because I had been an art major, I was very interested in that. I'd also worked as a medical illustrator. And when my life changed and I became separated and eventually divorced, I became interested and looked at OT as a possible second career. I actually drove up to the University of Florida, which was less than an hour away, and they at that time would not allow you to pursue a bachelor's degree, and that's what they offered if you already had a bachelor's degree. So I called the two programs that were closest to Florida, and they were the UNC in North Carolina and VCU in Virginia. And I happened to get Dr. Gary Kielhoffner as the director of graduate admissions when I made the call to VCU. And over the course of about an hour and a half telephone call, he made me realize that OT was the only possible career choice to be made.
That's really cool. They spoke with Dr. Kielhoffner, who we've learned about recently in our theory class that you taught us, who is the creator of the model of human occupation. And one of the theories that I like probably the best, actually. But can you tell me a little bit, any more detail about what he said that really convinced you to come to VCU?
You know, Gary was one of these people who was extremely charismatic, and he was a firm believer in OT and just so genuine about it. He had been a conscientious objector during the Vietnam era. He'd actually gone to seminary for a while and thought about being a Catholic priest. And so he was firmly against the war and against killing, and so he refused to, the draft, and so he became a conscientious objector, and that required that he do alternative service, and he ended up doing alternative service, working with clients with intellectual disabilities and working with OTs, and he, as a result of that, saw that OTs were doing incredible work. He was, quite a bit of an erudite himself. He was very well read and So he questioned the OTs about what they were doing and why, and what he told us later was that he could see that they could do the good work, but they couldn't explain what they were doing or why they were doing that work. And that's what led him into wanting to pursue OT as a career and help OTs learn how to explain the wonderful work that they did. So he went on to get a master's degree from the University of Southern California and studied under Mary Riley. And so all of this was part of the conversation that he and I had when I came to Richmond to look at the VCU program. And I was so completely impressed with his devotion and his commitment to the profession that I really made up my mind that I wanted to study with him. I wanted to learn from him. And I went to an interview immediately after that down at UNC, and I still to this day can't tell you who it was that I interviewed with there. But she said to me, "So you just interviewed with Gary Kielhoffner?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "What did he say?" And I told her, and I said, it was very inspiring. And she said, "Well, if it were me, I would study with him." So yes. She talked me out of going to UNC. So I came to Virginia and studied with Gary.
Well, there you go.
Wow, that is amazing. Such an honor to meet Dr. Gary Kielhoffner and all the people you studied with. It was just amazing. Can I ask you, can you explain how your own journey and the collaborative efforts with influential occupational therapists such as Dr. Gary Kielhoffner, Dr. Claudia Allen, Delma Sumsian, and Dr. Elizabeth Logan, how did that impact your view for client-centered practice, MOHO, and any other theories that you got from them?
Well, I obviously cut my teeth on MOHO studying with Gary. He taught my theory class. And at that time, now I was in school in 1982, so the MOHO articles came out in AJOT in 1980, so it was 2 years after that. He was a new professor at VCU. The first textbook on MOHO didn't come out until 1985, so he was literally typing his ideas on a typewriter in his office and taking them to the local Kinko store to be copied, and that's what we were using and we were studying. And then we studied a lot of articles that he had read that had influenced him as well, not just his work. So I really learned about MOHO as the ideas were developing, as they were evolving, and he frequently talked to us. And I was in a graduate master's class of 16 students, so that it was a small group, and we gave him a lot of feedback. I then, because I had such an interest in theory, I went on to learn from other theoreticians like Claudia Allen and the cognitive disabilities model, which I didn't actually learn to totally respect until many years later. And then Thelma Sumption is the developer of client-centered practice in Canada. She had been president of the Canadian OT Association, and I reached her by telephone to look for a qualitative research text that a member of her faculty had authored, but had since retired. And when I got her on the phone, I knew her by reputation very well. And I asked her if she might ever be willing to teach a course in client-centered practice for post-professional masters and OTD students in Canada. And when she said she would, I arranged a study abroad course to Canada for, I think there were 6 or 8 of us that went on that trip to actually Richmond, Canada, and it was an absolutely fabulous experience. But I have been strongly influenced by the ideas that came out of Canada and client-centered practice, and I still don't feel that OT in the U.S. fully understand it to the full extent with the way that it's been written about in Canada. Elizabeth Locon she's a gerontologist, and she's the developer of the OMA program. So she hasn't really impacted me in terms of my OT career, but she has influenced me on being able to work with the geriatric population and particularly clients with dementia. So she's really taught me so much about what art can do for people, even in fairly late stages dementia, but certainly in the early and mid stages of dementia.
Oh, wow. Yes, wow. It's amazing how many theorists and leaders in the field that you actually learn directly from and work with. It's amazing to be in one of your classes.
Yeah, I kind of hit the time in my career when theory was really big and being presented at AOTA, and so I had the chance to get to know Jeanette Scotty and Sally Schultz and talk with them about the occupational adaptation model, and Mike Iwawama with the development of the Kawa model, and Renee Taylor, who was Gary's wife, as she developed the intentional relationship model. So because I love theory, and I was just kind of in the right place at the right time when theory was evolving and developing in these places, I was able to study and learn directly from the authors of these OT models.
Yeah,
that's really cool. Do you think that these experiences influence you to develop a focus in any subspecialty of OT in particular, and eventually become a professor?
Gary certainly was an influence on me. I always wanted to work in mental health. That was the area that drew me to OT. And I loved working with adolescents, and that was predominantly what I did in my career. Because of that, the model was just such a wonderful fit that I started applying it immediately. But then when I was exposed to some other ideas, like some of the ideas relative mastery from occupational adaptation and the whole idea of looking at efficiency, effectiveness, and satisfaction and generating an occupational gestalt. And those ideas kind of just expanded what I knew about theory, and because I always practice with a real theoretically grounded way with the clients that I worked with. And I actually began teaching, I think I was only maybe 4 years out of school. And because I was working in mental health and I was working with adolescents, they needed someone to teach the adolescent psychosocial course to the undergraduate students. At that time, they were bachelor's students. And so they asked me if I would be willing to teach that class, and I thought it was a wonderful opportunity. So I started teaching as an adjunct, and I actually adjuncted in that course and in the theory course for about 7 years before I was asked to apply for one of the full-time positions that was coming available.
Wow, okay. So we're going to switch gears a little bit here, and I just was kind of curious as what you thought was one of the biggest obstacles to succeeding in occupational therapy today.
Wow, that's an interesting question, Alex. I have my own biases about practitioners, and I feel really strongly that to practice true client-centered practice that's occupation-based and occupation-focused, that it's essential for therapists themselves to have wonderful communication skills and really, really enjoy talking to people about their lives and what matters most to them and what gives them a sense of meaning and purpose. Because it's really generating that, you know, that interest that helps you work with them to define life-changing intervention. And I think it also takes having a really good repertoire of occupations and an openness to try and a lot of different ways to approach helping people accomplish their goals. So it's sort of a combination, but I think because my bias is probably towards more creativity, I think what made my practice really effective was having an open mind and really generating a lot of creative approaches or ways to be able to generate intervention methods and techniques.
Going with that thought, what are the most important character traits of a successful OT?
Oh, wow, David. That's, you know...
I need a loaded question, but...
Yeah, but I think for, you know, for an OT practitioner, and I'm talking about OTRs and OTAs, it's really a passion for wanting to help people, for really genuinely caring, a true desire to be able to help people, and having a willingness to want to go... to do everything that you can to help people accomplish what they would like to accomplish. And so when I've done some research in the past with therapists around client-centered practice, what separated the outstanding therapist from the ones that, you know, were good therapists but not necessarily, you know, outstanding was that the therapists that truly practiced in a client-centered way would do everything that they could. If that meant that they had to run the errands to be able to pick up additional supplies or even spend money out of their own pocket or other kinds of things, they made sure that their clients got just the very best of their energy and enthusiasm to help them.
Wow, yes, that's amazing.
Well, I want to thank you, Diane, for sharing that rich history so far. It was very interesting to hear all of that. And I know from being a student in your class, I can attest to that passion that I think has been trickling down through educators, it seems like, you know, through Gary, now through you, and, you know, through me. I remember one of the first classes that I had with the program at VCU, you dressed up as one of the prominent figures in OT history, and I just thought that, like, wow, this teacher is really got character to dress up in a graduate program. This showed kind of a testament to your personality and the passion that you had for the field. So I just thought that was a really cool thing that I had the chance to experience.
Well, I have to give credit to that to my husband, actually, because he went to a small liberal arts college here in Virginia, and he still keeps contact with his professors that he had when he was there, and, you know, and he's late 60s now, so that was 40-some years ago. But he had a particular professor who taught Civil War history, and he came in and one day, and he bent over behind his desk and turned around, and when he turned back around, he was dressed up as Abraham Lincoln and gave the Gettysburg Address. And you know, it made such an impact on him that still to this day, you know, it's just is one of his outstanding college memories that he had. He was a history major and loved, you know, to learn about the Civil War, and absolutely loved this professor. But so I thought, oh, it would be neat to dress up as Eleanor Clark Slagle and really kind of communicate to the students how special it was. So OT was birthed at a time with incredible people with nurses and doctors and architects and social workers and, you know, and artists, art teachers. It was just, we were born in an interprofessional crucible, and it's what made us special and what continues to make us special in my mind.
No, definitely. I think that the field is in need of good educators, and I think that's really going to help propel the field to expand and you know, be more inviting to different, you know, people that are considering occupational therapy. So I'm not having really set what education or what track I'd like to pursue in my educational career at this point, but I do want to let the listeners know that, unfortunately, you are about to retire after a very long and successful career. Isn't that correct?
Oh, no.
Yep. Only have a couple more months to go.
Couple more months. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. Well, it's, you know, it is a very strange time in our country's history, and a very time, you know, after 25 years of an academic career, it's an awfully unusual time to be retiring. I just finished teaching the introduction to OT class to the new 48 new OTD students, and I, you know, they were a wonderful group of students, and I'm really glad that I got a chance to meet one last group of students before I retired.
One last batch.
Mm-hmm.
I know. I'm thankful for having had you in the class, and as you talked about, you know, continuing those relationships, you know, hopefully that will still be something that we can do later on down the road. But I did want to know what your vision is in terms of the future for occupational therapy. How do you see the field growing or changing? What is your hope for how the field will change? Maybe you can possibly discuss the IPEC class that you are affiliated with and the role of interprofessional collaboration.
Wow, the future of OT. A few years back, I had the pleasure of meeting some graduates of our program that had been out of OT school for over 50 years. And one took my hand and asked me if I would sit down with her and talk to her about OT education now, and I did. And she looked at me and she smiled and she said, "The heart of OT is still there, and that makes me very, very happy." And it was just beautiful because she didn't go back as far as rehabilitation aids, but she learned about OT and Aura Ruggles, you know, idea that you reach for the heart as well as the hands. And so I think OT will change in the future. There's all kinds of potential. I mean, we're seeing it already in what's happened with COVID, with using telehealth, that will, I think, have the potential to expand our reach over some of the geographical limitations that we've had before. And there's certainly, you know, going to be a variety of opportunities through assistive technologies and working with older adults, and that will change, you know, as the profession ages. I mean, technology will influence and make a difference in how we contact people. Interestingly, when we had to switch over to COVID, different ways of doing groups, I was teaching the first, fieldwork one for the psychosocial for the second year students in the spring. And so half of the groups got to be face-to-face, and the other half had to be sort of simulated over Zoom, and only with fellow students rather than with clients, because we could no longer go to the facilities where we were delivering services. And one of the groups that was being done was a cooking group with people with serious mental illness who were limited in their knowledge of how to prepare food for themselves. And so they were eating a lot of prepared foods, you know, instant foods, that kind of thing. And they were afraid of knives and chopping and those kinds of things. So the students worked with them and teaching them knife safety and skills, and also introducing them to some adaptive pieces of equipment like finger shields that could be used for chopping to prevent, you know, a slip and cutting yourself. And that developed a level of confidence in the clients that was, you know, far different than anything they had experienced. But one of the activities, the whole group was designed based upon what the clients had asked that they wanted to learn. And they wanted to learn about cooking meat because they said none of them really knew how to cook meat. And so one of the meals that was cooked was tacos. And they used that for showing how to cook meat and making sure that the meat was cooked all the way through. So it wasn't red in the middle or, you know, pink in the middle. And so that was one of the groups that had to be switched to being done virtually. And so the student very cleverly took her laptop over to the stove, tilted the screen, and was talking to the screen and saying, now see how this area here, it's a little larger piece. Look what happens if I chop it in half. Can you see the pink that's in the middle of this? That's what you would want to make sure is all gone. So it's important to break up any of these clumps of meat and make sure that all of your meat is fully cooked and has turned brown. And when we were processing it afterwards about the experience of her teaching the group, I said, you know, if you had done this in person, you would never have thought to be able to use Zoom and to broadcast to the clients. But everybody could not have gathered around that pan and seen what you were showing there. And if you had had a laptop in the kitchen at the facility, you could have done this exact same thing with having a Zoom session set up and using or showing them what you were doing, even though it was face to face. So I think we're going to find that some of the techniques that we've had to develop by doing things on a virtual basis will expand the opportunity for ways that we might do things, whether it's teaching or actually with our clients, with groups in the future. So I think technology is going to be an important component to practice in the future. And so let me, the other thing that you asked about was a little bit about IPEC. I have been a strong proponent of interprofessional education since before it became an official class. I think 2015 at least, or maybe 14, we started some experiments with trying to bring some groups together, and 2016 was the first IPEC class that we had. And so we did not have, so 15 was the trial. 16 was the first year that we had OTD students, and we made it a required part of our curriculum. And so I am very, very strong supporter of OT students learning with other healthcare professionals, whether it's pharmacists or nurses or PTs or our dentists and dental hygienists, that people that you might think might not be a typical kind of person that OTs work with. You can discover ways that we can work together. We've worked with the dentist with around issues of oral sensitivities and, you know, and working with clients with disabilities who are frightened of going to the dentist. There's just all kinds of ways that professions can work together. I just finished on Friday a program called CIRCA, C-I-R-C-A-A, and it was a program that was offered by the Virginia Geriatric Education Center, and it stands for Creating Interprofessional Readiness for Working with Complex and Aging Adults. And when I found out about the program, it was a program that ran from September to June, once a month, and we had three retreats during that time as well. It was for practitioners from all around the state, either academics or clinicians, and so we worked together as interprofessional teams to learn about working in the area of gerontology. And so we all brought our respective expertise to working together and learning together, and it was a really fabulous experience. I wanted to do it because I had worked with adolescents for all of my clinical career, a little bit with adults, but mostly with adolescents. And I was getting interested in OMA and working with older adults with dementia, and I knew that I didn't have a very deep knowledge base when it came to working with older adults. So I decided to do this program in my last year before I retired so I could learn about working with older adults. And I learned so much about creating age-friendly healthcare environments. That just shows you there's learning interprofessionally. It was amazing. When you put a team together of a nurse and a pharmacist and a PT and an OT and a social worker, what we could all bring to understanding a case was amazing. And I want students to have some of those same experiences.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that you said all that and connected all the dots with, you know, the impact of COVID-19 and technology and, you know, the interprofessional care team and how that's all so intertwined and related. It's, how drastically this virus has impacted everything we do. It's really kind of changing how we practice. And, you know, as OTs, we're known to be flexible and adaptable. So we're kind of, you know, taking it all in stride. And, we've all kind of had changes. I know, speaking with David, he's also, you know, spoken about how his program's been impacted by this virus and kind of put on standstill for some aspects of the program. But I think that at this point we're going to switch gears again and talk about the involvement with Art for the Journey and Happening Minds through Art.
Okay.
Yes. So I'd like to introduce Art for the Journey and OMA, Opening Minds through Art. So Art for the Journey is a research-based nonprofit organization that promotes the health and well-being of young children and adults through creative expression and art-based programs. The organization works with various populations such as women in prison and people with dementia to overcome barriers and transform lives through creative art. So they've adopted the OMA training program style into one of their programs, which is a failure-free art program developed by Dr. Elizabeth Lika Lukin, who works with Scripps Gerontology at Miami University in Ohio. So the OMA program is the recipient of many awards and recognitions and was incorporated into the curriculum for OTD students at VCU recently. So I have a short audio clip that Dr. Lokin sent to me to help describe what OMA is, and it provides a firsthand account from an artist that worked with the Dublin Medical School at Ohio University.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy.
Most of us are here and we don't want to be, but when the young people come, then we're very happy. Very happy.
I just feel like I get so much, like, energizing for my soul just being with the residents.
This program is OMA. It's called Opening Minds Through Art, and it's an awesome program that pairs residents here at Mayfair Village with dementia, Alzheimer's, or other neurocognitive disorders with us student volunteers on a weekly basis to lead them through no-fail art projects.
Yes, it was very interesting. It had to do with creativity and art and camaraderie among all of us there.
Dealing with a condition like dementia, you're going to have, like, your resident not remember everything fully. But I feel like a part of this program that makes it positive is that despite the fact that she doesn't remember working with me, we are still able to connect every time and have just as much fun.
Oh, I love it because they're young and they come in with open attitudes and fresh opinions and good ways to look at things. So I feel as though I can learn so much from them by listening to them.
So definitely as a future physician, it will help me just have that perspective that I need when I work with my future patients who may suffer from similar conditions.
We've learned more about empathy and compassion and how we can bring that into medicine in the future, which has been incredible.
So there you have a little quick and dirty summary of what the OMA program entails. That was actually a YouTube video clip that was converted to an audio clip. So if you want to check out the actual video, we'll leave the link in the show notes there for you, give you another chance to see a video of some in-person videos and give you another chance to have your heartstrings pulled a little bit. I know if you're considering a specialization in gerontology as an OT or OTA practitioner, I think it's certainly a really great idea. I feel like our older population is kind of neglected in our culture, and I think it'd be a great way to give back to them as well as have a really rewarding experience for yourself.
Okay, so Diane, I wanted to know, how did VCU become involved with the OMA program? And can you give me a background on the creator of the program, Dr. Elizabeth Leek-Lokin?
Sure. I can do both of those things. So I was teaching the Fieldwork 1 psychosocial course several years ago, I think 4 or 5 years ago, and I had a master's student, two master's students who actually participated in the OMA program at St. Mary's Woods here in Richmond as volunteers. So they volunteered through an organization called Volunteer RVA, and they just found it as an opportunity. And so they actually shared one of the projects that had been used in OMA with the clients at a clubhouse that we were working at, or providing Fieldwork 1 experience at. And so it interested me. And then when we began to look for potential partners in the community, as a OT faculty, we knew that the third year students would be completing capstones during their last semester, and it would be pretty much the sole focus of their last semester in the program after they had completed their two fieldwork twos. And so we were encouraged to find people in the community with whom we may be able to partner and generate some relationships that could support some capstone students. So I reached out to the principals for Art for the Journey that offer OMA, Mr. Mark Herholzer and Cindy Pollen and Jamie Wigington, and we met for coffee at Starbucks to talk about their program and whether they might be interested in having a Department of OT capstone student, and they were very interested in doing that. So that eventually led to the first student that was last year, actually, Ingrid Durstein, and she completed her capstone with them. And the year before, when we were preparing, because you do the planning like a full year before the actual engagement in the process, we felt that she should get trained as an OMA facilitator. And I didn't feel that I could be a faculty advisor to her with doing that unless I had the training as well. So I paid for my own training, and I became an OMA facilitator. It was a hybrid program from OMA at Scripps Institute at Miami University, and then Art for the Journey has become a trainer's site, and so they are able to offer the practicum. And so Ingrid and I both became certified facilitators for OMA. I loved the program. I fell in love with it immediately when I was learning about it. It is so beautifully designed, and as both an artist and as an OT for many years, I was so impressed by it. Lika has done something amazing in the way that she's looked at these art projects. She has divided up the continuum of process and product, because normally for people with dementia that are working with someone like a rec therapist or someone else that might be working at the facility, an activity person, they do simple processes that result in simple products. But Lika separated those and developed a process of creating abstract art pieces that are created in layers. So it's a series of simple layers laid one at a time, laid over top of each other, creating a complex piece of abstract art that are beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful and frameable pieces, and there's an art show that's at the end of it. And so as an OT who has taught activity analysis and breaking things down, it blew my mind that it had never dawned on me to be able to do something like to break down a process into layered steps to create a complex product. And so I have since then been the advisor, the faculty mentor for two capstone students, and now I have my third, who is doing it this summer because of a grad 3 student because of COVID, and she could not go out to do her fieldwork too. And so she's also at Art for the Journey. And I have another one that is coming up in the next class. So so that will be my fourth capstone student working with Art for the Journey. Now, none of them to this point have done OMA, except the current student that just graduated. She developed a program for veterans, but she also served as an OMA facilitator at the St. Francis Home, which is where we arranged for the grad 1 students to have volunteer experience this past spring. So every student has gotten trained as OMA, but that hasn't been the focus of their capstone.
Yeah, that's actually where I got the idea from to do this podcast, because I thought it was such a cool idea, and it was something that was incorporated into our curriculum and our therapeutic process class. So I was actually one of the volunteers that did the volunteer training. And I had actually switched groups, so I was in the second group and luckily got in there before COVID-19 hit Virginia and had the group 3 be canceled. So I actually was lucky enough to get in there and have some firsthand experience to see what this program is about and to work hands-on with older adults that are suffering from various diagnoses. So I just thought it was a really cool experience, and in part 2 of the episode that we'll be working on here shortly, we're going to be hopefully working with Erin Oakley, who is the grad student who just finished her capstone, and also incorporating Cindy Pollan, who was mentioned earlier, that's associated with Art for the Journey. I just think it's a really awesome program that I think can be incorporated in a lot of different academic curriculums. But can you just briefly touch on, we'll get more into this in the second part of the podcast, but I was just wondering if you could touch briefly on some research and evidence-based practices that you saw, just kind of how OMA relates to OT.
You know, it's interesting, Alex, because Ashlyn Cunningham, who's at Maryville University, and I are the only two OMA trained facilitators who are OTs in the country, with the exception of the students that have gotten trained here. So it's an evidence-based practice that has won a number of awards in Ohio, but those haven't been in the area of OT. Those have been as providing extremely valuable services for clients with dementia. So the Scripps Institute focuses on gerontology. So those have been predominantly gerontologists that have done that. And you know, since you were one of the volunteers this past spring, that while I was doing the CIRCA program, that I knew I wanted to do a project that was related to OMA. And it had to be an action-based research project. So I started out by diving into the literature on OMA, but also on art programs and working with people with dementia. And what I discovered was that people with dementia were capable of demonstrating volition and engaging in activity, but the critical factor was having a social conduit, having a social partner to initiate the process. Because of mentation limitations, cognitive limitations that they have, they can't initiate. So they need someone else to initiate for them. And that goes for continuing as well, as a process skill, with being able to continue. But when they have a partner, a social partner there to help them engage, they can engage and they can experience pleasure and enjoyment in the process. So this is true both of music and of art with people with dementia. So I actually got into OMA as a result of the art, because I was attracted to the art with my art background. But when I got into the research, what I realized was what made OMA a powerful program was in part the art, but it was strongly because of the intergenerational relationships of the volunteers with the artist. So it works very closely with paired volunteers, and ideally those volunteers are with the same artist for an entire semester. So for all, 10, 11 weeks or whatever. We did it a little differently for class because I needed to get so many students through the program that they were only there for 3 weeks. But I had a brainstorm this morning when I woke up, and I've already written to Carol Ivey, to the chair, about this. And my idea is if we could get iPads through the department and supply them to St. Francis Home, Sarah, the activities director, who's an OMA facilitator there, could possibly create opportunities for students to pair up with 8 residents in the fall and in the spring. It doesn't have to be the same 8 residents both times, but what we would do is take the 48 students in the program, divide them in half, so 24 would do it in the fall, in the Friday afternoons in the fall, and the other 24 would do it Friday afternoons in the spring. And they would become partners, social partners, through the iPad. So, to be able to do it remotely. But to connect socially and to be able to watch and see everything that's going on and to connect with them. So I don't think that we're going to be able to go into an assisted living facility until such time as there's a vaccine. So it means that we won't have opportunities for, possibly up to a year from now. So the idea of trying to offer OMA virtually is just a new brainstorm of mine. So you're getting it hot off the presses. It's, it's only a few hours old at this point.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
I haven't talked with Lika about it yet, but I know she'd be all over it.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, we kind of have to adapt here and just use the technology that we have, but I think that's a really cool idea for still you know, having that opportunity to work with older adults and, you know, senior living mm-hmm. facilities because of the current situation and how we probably won't be able to have that opportunity for quite some time until this vaccine is, you know, developed, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Stay posted because it's changing.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, exactly. Alex, I just wanted to ask you about your experience with the program and, like, how has it changed your views with art and occupational therapy and also the dementia population?
Well, I did not have that much experience working with older populations. I have a lot of experience working with pediatrics, but not so much with older adults. And it was an interesting experience for me to go into that situation because it is a very intimate relationship that you're developing with somebody. You know, you're spending a lot of one-on-one time with them over the course of a couple weeks. And there's a lot of downtime where you have to fill that time with some conversation. And, you know, you're not really told exactly what the person's diagnosis is. And to some extent, I think that's good because you're almost, instead of just going in with a mindset, hey, you're going to work with this person, you kind of have an open slate. And mm-hmm. I kind of learned to be a little bit more flexible and sit back and relax and just kind of see where the conversation went, but also to be mindful of, you know, utilizing open-ended questions and, you know, to work on that relationship because that social interaction that you're giving that person is really worthwhile, I think, on both sides of the coin there. But, you know, Diane mentioned the intergenerational aspect of it, and, you know, the person may not necessarily remember you from time to time, but, mm-hmm. you know, that positive affect that you're giving them and, you know, the good warmth and love that you're sharing with that person is really something that is important to them. And, you know, I think that it is very important for our culture and for people to learn from, you know, past generations and, you know, have that relationship with your parents or your grandparents or, you know, strangers in the community so that you actually learn from the past and we can all move forward and kind of move in a positive direction.
Yes, that makes so much sense. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and experience.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess at this point, we have part two of the episode that is coming up, as I mentioned previously, with Aaron Oakley and Cindy Pollan, and we're going to get a little bit more in detail and go in depth in terms of what it's like for a grad 3 to do their capstone on a project and work with a company for Art for the Journey. And Cindy's going to be sharing her side of the experience from being a director and also talking about how IoT fits into their various many programs as well. So, David, did you have any questions that you wanted to still ask, or did you want to talk about maybe your experience with art with your program?
Oh, well, I wanted to ask about the new changes, you know, since we are experiencing the COVID times right now. But Diane touched on it a little bit with her idea this morning about introducing iPads and using that and using a digital format or like a telehealth format instead to try to reach the patient, which I thought was really amazing. And my other question was, how can we as future OT practitioner gear the focus of OT towards mental health?
You know, mental health is where we came from. It's where OT was founded in mental health with even moral treatment and that coming over to this country. But it was really in the institutions and the asylums that OTs really began their work. And then eventually we're also in tuberculosis asylums and polio. This was all before, you know, World War I and World War II changed things. But mm-hmm. we know that occupations affect our physical bodies and our mental, emotional, social being. And so to treat holistically, we have to treat the body and the mind. They're not separate. They're one. They're unified. And so that mind-body connection has to be treated. I have a personal bias that I absolutely love working with a clientele in the mental health community. I've worked in the area of addiction. I've worked in the area of corrections and in psychiatric facilities. And OTs have so much to offer this population. I think we're seeing a resurgence now. AOTA has worked very hard to have OT recognized by SAMHSA as one of the, professions that provides mental health services. Here in this state, we've worked to have OT identified as a qualified mental health provider. So getting that recognition that we provide mental health, and then getting people to practice in that area. But I see more and more students that are showing an interest. And we just had 2 days in the last couple of days of the introduction course where different practice settings were discussed. And I had many more people interested in community mental health and even in inpatient mental health than I remember having in a long time. So I hope that we've kindled some ideas and people will continue in that area. Even in the capstones, there's more interest in trauma-informed care, working with children, both in specialty settings and also in school systems and that kind of thing. So I think trauma-informed care is going to inform OT practice as well.
Oh, yes, perfect.
Yeah, I think, as a holistic profession, we definitely have to consider, the person, the environment, and the occupation, and how all that is very, very much interconnected. So
that's what drew me into the profession of OT, just having, the whole mind, body, and soul, not looking at a person as just a patient or a number, looking at them as actual someone that you want to help heal and have a better quality of life.
Yeah, I completely agree. So, David, what has your experience been with art and OT?
Okay, so first, art, I've never been a really big fan of art since I was a kid, maybe because I wasn't, too great at it. I was really great at doing stick figures. But whenever I got into the OT program and we talked about art, I was a little skeptical. I was like, okay, I know that the profession of OT, blossomed out of the reform movement of the late 19th and early 20th century, and that was especially with the arts and crafts and moral treatment movement. And so I know that it's deeply rooted in arts and crafts, so I was like, okay, I'm going to try to keep an open mind, as all OT should. And so did arts and crafts, and I took the class, and it was really amazing. First, I thought, oh, I don't want to do it. I don't want to paint. I don't want to make red houses. I don't want to leather or do anything like that. But reading about it and how it helps people and seeing it like firsthand and how it helps people, then our teachers made us do the crafts and things in class. And some of the, now I really like lettering, surprisingly, which is amazing. It was really calming and therapeutic. All I was doing is it was just a moment that clicked. And I was just like, yes, it makes sense. I see how this can be therapeutic, because it's not only, just about doing art and moving that. Art can do so much and has the potential for so much therapeutic application, like motor control, sensory, like perceptual stimulation, especially with people with cognitive challenges. And also, when you're done with the art and it looks pretty amazing, it enhances your self-esteem. So that also helps us fuel our therapy. And I just thought, whenever you brought this to me and you said, let's do OMA, I was just like, oh, perfect. I've just recently fallen in love with art and therapy, and this is just perfect for us to do this. So thank you so much for involving us, and thank you so much.
Well, good, David. Maybe you'll want to get trained as an OMA facilitator one of these days.
Yes, I would love to. Yes, yeah. I just have to just waiting to graduate, you know, waiting to finish my rotation, and then I will be sending you an email soon, hopefully.
That would be great.
Yes. I think arts and crafts, like you said, goes hand in hand with occupational therapy, and there's so many activities that you can use through that mode to help people grow and work on different skills. So we'll definitely, if you want to ever talk arts and crafts or anything OT, we'll leave our contact information in the show notes here, and we'll leave some information about the OMA program so you can look it up if you do want to follow up on any of this information. We will be having a part two episode, so please keep a lookout for that. And in order to wrap things up here, we just wanted to know, Diane, if you had any inspirational quotes or stories that you would like to share with the listeners that may be considering a career in occupational therapy.
Well, you know this very well, Alex. My favorite quote has been and will always continue to be Mary Riley's famous quote from her 1962 Eleanor Clark Slagle lecture, that man, through the use of his hands, is energized by his mind and will, has the capacity to influence his own health. I believe strongly that this is to be true. Mary was so far ahead of her time, but her ideas influenced Gary's ideas and the model of human occupation. And I learned just how incredible the human is, that our ability to be able to look and see with binocular vision, bend over and pick up and use opposable thumbs to pick up and do fine motor kind of examination, and through our incredible arms and hands and wrists, that the kind of manipulation and in-hand manipulation that we have. I'm just fascinated by the hands. I'm fascinated by the human will to be able to generate things. So we didn't stay at people that just made pots. We decorated them, and we decorated them with great detail. So we have a desire for the aesthetic. We love the arts, and we're capable of being able to do it. And I think it is something that is such a part of who we are, that when we get the chance to be able to explore creative opportunities, we really satisfy something that's very deep inside all of us, and so I love being able to help people discover that.
All right,
that is amazing.
Yeah, that is a great quote. Well, I just want to thank you again, Diane, for your time with speaking with us today. It's been very informative and very inspirational. So I want to thank the listeners as well, and David, for your help on this podcast. So thank you very much, Diane.
Good luck to both of you all in your podcasting. Sounds like fun. I hope you enjoy your partnership and going forward and making more podcasts.
Take care.
All right, thank you.